To the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have five oral arguments on our calendar today. This is the last oral argument. I will ask the marshal to call case.
Calling case A21-0629 in the matter of the welfare of the child of J.H. Parent.
Now, just a couple of quick remarks before I'll turn it over to the lawyers. So we are recording today's proceedings that will be available to you on the court's website. As a result, we ask you to identify yourself as well as the client you represent before you begin your remarks. And then you should see on the screen an indication of how much time is remaining. It will count down for you. And so please keep your eye on that. Our conversations tend to move quickly. So we look forward to speaking to both of you. We are ready to hear from counsel for appellant when you are ready.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Zachary Johnson, and I represent the appellant in this matter, who is identified by his initials J.H. Your Honors, I'd like to make a few points about this case. I know that my brief is rather lengthy. And I'm not going to be able to cover each and everything I'd like to cover, perhaps, but I'd just like to kind of hit on the salient points and turn it over to the court for questions. The first, when it comes to the standard of review in this case, I would just like to point out that there really weren't any factual disputes in this trial of any moment in terms of credibility or sufficiency of the drug testing or anything of that nature. I think the facts are pretty much all in agreement as between the two sides here. And so really, from the appellant's perspective, what we're asking the court to do is simply to review this record and determine as a matter of law, essentially, whether there was substantial evidence to support the district court's conclusions. So we're not asking this court to second guess any of the fact findings necessarily, because I think we're all in agreement. My client admitted to using at the times that he admitted to using. And so this case really is about whether or not the facts were sufficient to support the conclusion in light of the totality of the circumstances that surrounded this case. Your Honors, I would just essentially boil it down to this. My client is the biological father of the child at issue. And the early on in the case, the mother had kind of bowed out and decided that she didn't want to have anything to do with the child. So the natural next step was to place the child with my client. At this time, he had a trial home visit, or I can't remember if it was protective custody, but he had the child for a while before he did test positive. And so testing positive, really, and methamphetamine use on the part of my client is the condition that led to removal. And it should be the focus, and it was the focus of this trial. But really the question is, Did everything that took place from the filing of the CHIPS petition until the date at trial adequately address the condition that led to removal? In other words, did the county's reasonable effort or the county's efforts in correcting his substance abuse issue, were they reasonable? And additionally, were there factors outside of the county's control that made it very difficult, if not impossible, for my client to obtain this or to achieve these goals within a timeline that was effectively compressed because of the timing of this case?
Mr. Johnson, if yes. I may ask you about that, because I understand that a lot of what you're talking about is the impact of the pandemic on your client's ability to access what for him was more effective in-person treatment, as well as the inability to have personal visits with the child for a period of time. Am I stating that fairly?
Yes.
And I would, if the district court did not grant an extension, I would have even more sympathy. I mean, and I say even more sympathy because it is clear to me reading this transcript that your your client truly cares, truly and deeply cares about his child. And I understand that. But when I look at the timelines, which I think is like 6 months to permanency for a child under the age of eight, you know, if COVID had happened and there was no visitation and that timeline wasn't extended, I would, as one, speaking for myself and not for the panel, have real problems with that. But at the county's suggestion, the district court did extend that timeline. And so when we look at the time, even as I look at it, even if we take, if we subtract those days that there was no in-person visitation or that the foster parents, I think there was some COVID in the fall, and take them out, it's still more than the 6 months, right?
Well, that is true. That is true, Your Honor. The issue is that, well, at least in terms of the application to extend the timelines, that is actually, it's been my experience that that application is granted if the parent is making significant progress in a garden variety case. And so if, of course, the parent is not making any progress and it's reasonable that the parent's not making any progress, well, then the court would not grant the extension. So
if I may, Mr. Johnson, when I looked, but you know the record better than I do, I didn't see anything in the record as far as why, other than the fact that the county requested the extension. But as far as whether that was because your client was making progress or because there was this pandemic that was, you know, limiting your client's ability to, among other things, see the child. I mean, is there anything in the record that says this is why the district court made this extension?
Your Honor, that's an interesting question. And I don't know if there is or if there was, I certainly am not aware of it. Perhaps that's something that Mr. Eklov could answer. I do know that it is up to the county to make a determination whether or not they're going to file a permanency petition in the case, and it could have just been in the exercise of discretion that they did not do that. I've seen in cases where judges order the county to file permanency petitions if they do not sense that things are going well. And I don't recall the Judge Austed did that at all in this case. And so it could have just been an assumption or perhaps an understanding that things were not as they normally are in the course of this particular CHIPS case that caused the court not to order the county to file that permanency petition, or perhaps it's just the county felt it was not appropriate at that time. But I there is probably, if the court were to look at the orders, there would probably be an order in there somewhere where Judge Austed said that the timelines would be extended. And that could have just come about as a result of a conversation that we had on the record or an informal application that was made to the court. But I would say that that type of request is routinely made in cases that are, I'm going to just keep referring to them as sort of garden variety cases that come up from time to time where the parent is making progress. The attorney will oftentimes ask for an additional period of time to complete the conditions. And it's I think the reason for that is if you look at what the guardian ad litem, and I think even the parental capacity assessor and social services, they all say they want to see 6 months of continuous sobriety in cases involving substance abuse. And if we're talking about a case where we have a 6 month timeline and the services don't, you know, get signed up for, or they don't, you know, all the different things that need to be done in order to set that up, if that doesn't start, for even a month, then it's impossible for the parent to reach those goals or those standards within the traditional 6 month period.
Mr. Johnson, did your client ever ask for an extension of the timeline?
Did he personally or through his attorney?
I don't know,
Your Honor. I would assume that, and I can't say this with any knowledge, but I would assume that this extension was requested or discussed at one of the earlier court proceedings, because they were extended, and I'm sure there would have to be an order in there somewhere.
Okay, if I may, I guess a second extension. Did your client through his counsel or in one of the proceedings, ask for an second extension? Because I know that your client opposed the permanency petition, but I that was not clear to me.
There was never a formal request for a second extension beyond this, just an extension of the timelines that would have come at the 6-month mark. The permanency petition was filed, and the procedural posture at that time, from our perspective, was to simply oppose the petition. So I wanted to point out, I understand my time's already getting short here, but the way that things worked in this case was that at the very beginning of his treatment, he did receive treatment through Anderson Jor and Mark Anderson. It was in-person treatment, and it required him to show up, get out of bed, go take a UA, and benefit from a group setting. And I think that's the recommended way to address these substance abuse issues, because then you can talk to other people who have gone through similar things, and you've got a level of accountability to the group and personal responsibility with the UAs. And during that period of time, once the initial drugs got out of his system, there was a pattern that he was providing negative UAs. Then when the emergency order came into effect, which prohibited in-person treatment, that's when we started to see the slippage. And I would just direct the court's attention to what Mark Anderson himself said about the treatment that was being provided at the from the period of March and April of 2020 through July 2020, which he called his own treatment disgraceful, and it was something that would not have benefited anybody. Or it could have even affirmatively harmed. Maybe that was a little bit of hyperbole on his part, but certainly not something that would be beneficial, and certainly not the same level of treatment that a similarly situated parent would have received, but for the occurrence of this pandemic, which I'm calling a force majeure in an argument that I make elsewhere in the brief. So,
Mr. Johnson, I mean, what troubles me, and I understand what you're saying on the during the kind of really during the shutdown when there was only virtual treatment, but once in-person treatment was available, my understanding of the record, and correct me if I'm wrong, is your client missed some of those in-person treatment scheduled appointments. Is that not true?
That definitely is true. And there was a 3-month period essentially from September until December where he essentially fell off the map. I mean, there's no denying that. And when he was asked about that, he was very candid about it and admitted to the fact that he was using during that period. But I think the issue is that if he had received the treatment at the outset, if he would have been able to continue with that, I think the facts bear out the idea that he would have done well and he would have continued and he would not have had this 3-month gap in treatment and visitation, because he would have been successful. And how do we know that? Well, because when he did actually re-enroll, his last use was on Christmas Day of 2020. When he actually did re-enroll in-person treatment, it was effective. And there all the UAs, I think the exception, there was one that was dilute, but there had been no positive UAs for over 3 months at the time that the trial started. And so what I would posit is that is proof that if we didn't have this intervening event of the pandemic that disrupted his treatment, then that would have just continued on. And even if we had got to June, rather than this case was tried in March, if we had gotten to June, the social services guardian ad litem and parental capacity assessor, all of their standards for non-use would have been met. And so when you look at the reasons that are put forth, and I think it's pretty consistent throughout all the county attorney, guardian ad litem, parental capacity assessor, and then ultimately the district court judge, their main point was 12 months have passed. And so that would be the time limit. And so we cannot keep things open any longer than that. And so we're going to apply the timeline and terminate. And I think for the reasons that I set forth in the brief, that would be a fundamentally unfair result in this case. And so we're asking the court to reverse the district court judge. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. So we've reset the clock, and counsel for respondent, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you. This is John Eklov. I'm assistant Cass County attorney, and I represent the respondent, Cass County Health Human Veteran Services, in this matter. As counsel stated, this is a termination of parental rights matter. J.H., his parental rights to his son, C.S. I agree the issue, primary issue is whether substantial evidence supports the finding below. And it is true there were not really any disagreements in what the basic evidence is. It's the gloss that it's put on it. However, one of the items that I would like to refer to is if the court finds substantial evidence in the record justifying the finding below, especially as to at least one statutory ground for termination, that the best interests of the child justify termination, and finally, that reasonable efforts were employed, the court should affirm the order below. And it's our position that all those were met in this case, citing SEPT and TAA, In Re the Welfare of, and those are fairly stock cases and standards of review. In this case, I will primarily refer to the first ground, which was that, that the parental relationship was repeatedly refused or neglected to comply with that relationship, and that refers to JH doing that, because it deals with so many of the other components that fill out the other two statutory grounds. Basically, the district court hearing the case below, and I have to say that the order that the district court issued was very detailed. I believe there were 132 findings of fact, 43 conclusions of law. The court received 85 exhibits, and I think 9 witnesses testified over a 2-day trial. So the court looked at a lot of things before it issued that order. One of the things it referred to is failure of one of the major components of the case plan can be termed failure to comply with that parental relationship, citing In Re Simon 662 Northwest 2nd 155 at 163, a 2003 Court of Appeals case. And in this case, the performance of that case plan was certainly a zigzag operation. Counsel referred to testing. There would be a number of tests that would be negative, then there would be a positive test. I'm referring to the UAs that are in the exhibits and are referenced in my report. And one has to remember the original removal came from a series of 5 out of 6 patch tests that were positive for methamphetamine. So there was that. Then there were periods of time where there was no testing in the fall of 2020, as counsel stated in his elocution, the JH basically dropped off the map. Kevin Geislinger from the agency, Ross Resources, was trying to find him during that time period to get him tested. From September 30 until December 14, there was no UAs at all. He was not in treatment at the time. Excuse me.
Mr. Eklov, I wanted to think about that period of time too, and certainly that period of time where we didn't see any visitation between father and son is of a concern. But don't we have to really back out some time here, perhaps back out the time where he wasn't able to do visitation because I think the foster parents had COVID or there was some COVID exposure? Wasn't there a chunk of that time in the fall, as well as the time from March through, I think, early July, when in-person visitation wasn't possible? I mean, when we're looking at whether or not there was that you know, complying with parental duties, isn't that important?
There was no in-person visitation from, as Your Honor mentioned, from March till July. However, he was offered visitation through either Zoom or whatever provider was available. What that signified to the court was basically what did that indicate as far as his willingness to form some kind of attachment with the child? There's obviously an infant isn't going to be talking with him and conversing with him, but what does it show as far as him not wanting to see the child, not wanting to perhaps sing to the child, see the child develop over that period of time, still form an attachment to the child? I can't back away from the fact that that's significant. And the parenting capacity assessor, Barbara Carlson, also found that to be significant. The inability to appreciate the gap and what that meant to the child. And of course, in the fall, that was simply him going off the map from September 16 until December 14, there was nothing. And Robin Parks from Ross Resources was bird dogging him, trying to find him to get that set up. So I do not dismiss that first 4 months so easily. I believe that it was critical to his perception of how important that relationship was. Wouldn't you want to see your child? Wouldn't you want to, even if you're talking nonsense to a baby, it's a key into his mind, his insight, and his appreciation of how important his relationship was to that child. And Barbara Carlson, I believe in her testimony, talked about his inability to perceive how he was damaging the child and his relationship with the child by his non-presence.
I suppose I will push back a bit on that, counsel. I mean, I think there's a difference. I mean, I understand what you're saying about the fall, though I do think there is some of this COVID restriction, visiting restrictions we have to take in consideration. But, you know, and of course, you know, we would want to see one have a parent have interest in how the child is doing. But, you know, where was your testimony about being able to bond with an infant that age over Zoom? I mean, because isn't that part of what we're trying to look at when we're, you know, considering the failure to comply with parental duties?
Well, there was some testimony by, I believe, the guardian ad litem, and that would be Kathleen Barda, about that. And basically that what she testified was basically all her other clients that she had were faced with the same dilemma, and they elected to do that, to actually broadcast over with children as young as infants to 17-year-olds. She also testified about the concern that apparently there was some bonding that could take place. There was no particular study that she cited. There was a bulletin that was placed apparently to guardians ad litem. It sounded like it was statewide to that effect. But what Ms. Carlson testified to about was what it showed as far as his ability to even desire a form of bond with the child. And the court thought that was critical, that he had basically absented himself for significant periods of time with this child. And of course, in the fall, in-person visitation commenced in July and would go till the end of the time. And he was gone, and they were trying to find him. And at times he would be offered, for instance, he couldn't do, because of his test, Christmas wasn't in the offing, but they offered him a time a week before, as long as he had a negative test, and he didn't want to do that. He was more willing to work at his part-time job. Also critical was he was poised to go to unsupervised visits in August of 2020. And he tested positive, and that was canceled. The inability to move to the next level, to get to a trial, to unsupervised visitation, to then to a trial home visit, and then to return. As important as that was, Brooklyn Trombley testified that he knew this, the significance of this thing, and he still used. And he, in his own testimony, he testified that when he was found positive with these tests, it wasn't because it was environment, it was use. So he knew that, and he went ahead anyway and did it, and lost the ability to move ahead at that point. And at that point, we are in the second half of after the timeline extension has happened. That happened June 2 at the Permanency Progress Review hearing. And back then, the county, I believe, and the Guardian and Lynham did not oppose the extension by the court doing that, because at that point he was still in treatment, albeit we know that it was Zoom treatment, but he was still there. I'd also like to point out
Do you have any light to shed on the question I asked Mr. Johnson as well, which is there anything in the record that states the county and it appears the Guardian's reasons for, and or the district court's reasons for it, the extension? You know, was it, Mr. Johnson was saying, well, that's typically done when the parent's making progress. On the other hand, we're in the middle of COVID with all these restrictions. Perhaps that was it. Is there anything in the record that would indicate that?
I don't believe there was any reference to COVID that I recall. But there was to the fact that he was doing something in the case plan at the time. He was still in treatment. And so he would, there still were some UAs that were done as far as his treatment provider, and the county was still doing it. Ross Resources couldn't do it at that point, and they didn't start up again until September. But I don't think there was any reference that I recall to COVID-19. It was basically because he was still, at least from what we could see, involved, that it was willing to take that risk within that time frame for the sake of the child. Because the idea was we wanted to reunify with him, obviously. It was only at the end, when this period of time when he was basically, he told Ms. Carlson that she asked him during her assessment, why was he willing to re-engage suddenly and go to treatment and do all these things? It was because his attorney told him that the county was going to terminate on him. And in fact, indeed, the county had put that in a review in December 29, the review notice that went to the court, that was going to happen. And at that point, he calls the social worker and what do I need to do? Whereas before that time, there seemed to be no appreciation to what he needed to do. But at that point, we're already through with the second 6 months as far as the timeframes. And those timeframes do matter. Every day is significant in the life of a child, and that's why we have them, because permanency is important and attachment is important, which is something that Ms. Carlson was concerned that he appreciated, and also Ms. Barta, two of the witnesses who testified with exceedingly great experience. I think Ms. Barta had 19 years working with children's family therapy and licensed was an MA psychologist, and also 17 years as a GAL, guardian ad litem. And the other witness, Barbara Carlson, her CV is in the record at Exhibit 34. So they found that very significant. At any rate, time frames finally do matter with respect to attachment issues. I think there was testimony from Guardian Lightham to that effect, that by that time, the child had attached to the foster parents, who are a prospective permanency option, and that removal would be damaging to the child. And that was part of the testimony, I think, that the court credited, besides that of Ms. Carlson, about lack of understanding of what the damage being done by not concentrating on his relationship with the child during that time frame, and getting his casework done and just seeing the child. All those things fed into what the court finally decided to do. And I believe that the court's findings by clear and convincing evidence are there. And the services that were provided in the end were the best that could be done under the timeframes. And in fact, later on in the timeframe, reverted back to the regular in-person formats, with respect to visitation, with respect to testing, with respect to everything. And in fact, were reasonable efforts. So I believe the three prongs that were I mentioned are justified by the evidence that's in the record, by substantial evidence, and this court should affirm. I believe I've got 51 seconds, and at that point, I rest on my brief. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. So, Mr. Johnson, we have reset the clock, 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you choose.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Just to respond to a few things that Mr. Eklov said, Mr. Eklov talked about the period of time when in-person visits were about to resume. And it was interesting because it was framed as though it were a choice. And I think what the court has to understand and does understand is that we're talking about an addiction here. We're not talking about a choice about what to have for breakfast this morning or, you know, to, you know, go this way or that way when you're making a trip. We're talking about a very powerful substance, and a substance that, as we've all seen, can take complete control of a person and change them from perhaps what would otherwise be a normal, loving parent into someone who appears to be disengaged. And the whole purpose behind requiring these reasonable efforts at rehabilitation is so that a person who is under the power of this type of addiction can receive the treatment that they need. And that's really what this case is about. It's not about a choice. Given two options, J.H., it's almost like it's being simplified to the point where he's saying you could have your child or you could have this hit of meth. And it's just not that simple. It's not that cut and dry. A person in his situation needs treatment, and he responded well to treatment. In fact, his record is nearly perfect when he's receiving treatment. So he can, and he has demonstrated the fact that he can overcome this addiction if he's given the proper services. There was talk about reasonable efforts, and I just want to touch on a few points in that regard. One of the items in the case plan that was put together in April of 2020, which, by the way, the social worker in this case had been assigned in February of 2020, was for JH to receive a parental capacity examination or assessment. And that assessment was not even attempted to be scheduled until October of 2020. So we're talking about a 6-month gap of no effort on the part of the county whatsoever to make that happen. And you know, I don't want to take an overly cynical view of this assessment, but can it realistically be said that this assessment was designed to aid JH in any way at reunification when the permanency petition was filed in such a short time period after the assessment was rendered? I would say no. But if the assessment had been done at the appropriate time, there were recommendations in the assessment that could have been followed by the county. The county could have followed up with services based on that assessment. But due to the fact that the assessment simply wasn't scheduled, those services could not happen. And I don't know if that was the fault of Ms. Trombley or not. I don't think that it matters necessarily in this case. I think what matters is the fact that this was a crucial part of his case plan that was not implemented, and that was not JH's fault whatsoever. I would also note that this was kind of a strange case in that it was the social worker's, essentially her first case, that she had not handled a case like this on her own. She said that the history of her employment is recounted on the record, but I think she started and then she received 10 cases and this is one of the first 10. there was a gap and there's no record. I'm sorry, before I finish that point, there was no record that she had been supervised by anyone or that anyone was giving her guidance as to how to proceed with this file. Then there was, she did admit that there was a 3-month period of time when she simply didn't reach out to JH at all during the pendency of these proceedings. And it wasn't because of COVID or any other reason. I think what she said was that she was simply too busy with her other cases. And again, I'm not trying to be overly critical of her in her situation, but these are reasonable efforts and how they ought to be judged. So my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors, for considering the case.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thanks to both lawyers in this case. We very much appreciate hearing from you and your thoughts on this case. It's now submitted to us.